Now, gentlemen, you're looking at a man that's been drafted into the Ukrainian army, so we're shielding him, if that's what it amounts to. I begin with both a happy announcement and a very sad dedication. First of all, today is first day Hanukkah. It's Monday, December 3rd, 2018. And as I began class yesterday telling you that since Dove saw me last, I became a multimillionaire. I had a great-granddaughter Thursday night. I became a multimillionaire last night. I had a great-grandson. But more than that, yesterday was my birthday. I now have the greatest birthday gift I ever got, a great-grandson on my birthday. Yeah. So Kanayin Hara, the Abishter, has been kind. And then my brother called me this morning. He just had a great-grandson, I believe he told me, Mulfat Tumbleton. Kanayin Hara, when we added up what we have, we've done our share to increase the population of the state of Israel. That's on a happy note. On a very sad note, and I dedicate today's shiur, Dr. Richie Friedman. And first of all, if I tell you, who remembers from the Upper West Side when we were growing up, there was Dr. Shabbos Friedman. Do you remember the name Shabbos? Everyone called him Shabbos. He was probably the only Shomer Shabbos doctor in all of Manhattan. And he had a guy who worked for him on Shabbos. In case there was an emergency, he drove him, or he walked with him and carried his bag. You know, there was no Erev. Whoever dreamt of an Erev then? So Dr. Shabbos Friedman had a son, Dr. Ira Friedman. No one knows him. Heart specialist, wonderful human being, Jew doctor. He had a son, Richie Friedman. Richie Friedman continued the tradition of the family, and then discovered his roots, that his elder Zayde was above of a chassid, and in the last 20 years I would meet him Shabbos occasionally. There's a world-class medical doctor, founder of the Hatzalah in Lawrence, with a bekesha, the works, above of a chassid. Oh. He was killed Shabbos, walking home from shul, on, if you know Lawrence, if you know the area, he was killed on Broadway, on there's Central, and then a block over is the other big street, Broadway, and this is maybe the fourth or fifth, I don't know, someone from the five towns can direct me, but I know maybe four or five different incidents in the last 30 years, people killed walking home to shul or from shul. It breaks the heart. A young man. Nothing to do with hit and run. You cross, there are no lights there. That's the problem. It's suburbia. If you know, anyone here know the five towns? I don't want to talk in Veltorine, but if you know the five towns, you have a light at Central Avenue when you come down Rockaway Turnpike, and then the next light is all the way over on Far Rockaway when you're hitting the White Shul in Far Rockaway. So you have about a mile where there's no light. It's suburbia, no lights, suburbia. The cars fly. And it doesn't mean hit and run. It could be a driver who stopped, but never. So I dedicate today's shiur in his memory. I can tell you a funny story. My wife and I always laugh about this. And this is a true story. B'didi Havayuvda. In 1990, I was Masada Kedushin in Chicago. A Talmud of mine got married. A Talmud, his parents were Litvisha survivors from the Vilna area. And we bonded very closely in maybe the second or third year of BMT. And we remained very close until today. And this Talmud went on to become a world-class medical doctor, got married quite late, married a girl from a hyped Satmar family, Chicago. So he brought me in from Israel, the Sadeh Kedushin. And you got to understand that this wedding, it was a well-to-do family, and she was the almana, the father wasn't alive anymore. So all the Satmar Gabayim from miles around were there, and all the Rashi Yeshiva, it's a family, gave a lot of tzedakah. As a matter of fact, she came over to me after I was Masada Kedushin, and she said, I couldn't believe my ears. She said, all the betting for me, geld, and do business, can get you. Everyone asking money, and you don't ask money. I said, look, I teach for YU, I don't have to, if you, no, ich will epistan, I want to do something for you. So I told her, contribute to Shvatami, and she made a nice contribution to Shvatami. Anyway, I'm a Sada Kedushin. Okay. That summer, I'm visiting Irwin Shapiro in Lido Beach's summer home, and I'm giving a shear in the shul there. And sitting in front of me is Richie Friedman, mitzvahing Bekesha, and in the middle of my shear, he starts to cry. I did a shear, whatever, was Shas, Paiskim, I was, I love this shear. What are you crying? I don't know. Guy's crying. After the shear, he comes over to me, I have to ask Mechila from you. And his father is laughing. I said, what the heck is going on? You know, I've given many shirim, I've given all over the world, Kanai and Hara. The father's laughing, he's crying. So the father told me he came back from Chicago, was doing his residency. So Pesach, he was home for the Seder, it's 1990. And he told his parents, you know, very funny, we had this Satma wedding in Chicago, and all the hype Satma were there. And the Masada Kedushin was a reform rabbi from Jerusalem. And then when he heard the shir, he realized, I'm the guy, I'm the one who spoke under the, I'm the reform rabbi. So I told him, you're absolutely right. Maybe I should have a long beard and pay us and wear a bekesha the way you do. But what can I do? I am what I am. Okay, so I dedicate the shir in his memory, and with all the joy of the simcha, Malk and I, we feel so bad, you have no idea, because there were only two children there, and his sister was born challenged, and his mother, Erica, always said, my Richie, there was such pride in him. And you know my soft spot for Hasidus, when I see a world-class medical doctor, and his roots and above of it, and he's proud of it, I had such nachat, you have no idea. And we have no solution, and Rakefet is right. Anyone, Dove, I heard you went and demonstrated against computers. If you don't demonstrate against computers, they do little harm. Cars kill millions. No more cars. We should yell and shout, abolish cars, period. A dear student who is a Rebbe and a Machanaich for many years in Ramaz, Rabbi Yossi Wise, I've met him, wonderful individual. So he made one correction that I accept, one correction I don't accept, and one point that I want to repeat. The correction that I do accept is when I got involved with the... I knew I made a mistake, and I meant to correct myself, but all right, it's unimportant compared to everything else on my mind. I spoke about the rally for Soviet Jewry in the late 80s, so I think I said 1 million Jews were there. 250,000 Jews. It was the largest conglomeration of Jews ever in the modern world. I don't think in Israel we ever hit 250,000 Jews at one time. Even at the Kotel, you get millions over Cholamoid, but at one moment, Birkat Kanim, they say there are 50,000, there are 60,000, 250,000. In Washington. You were there? No, I know what went on. Now, I was right that Aguda didn't participate, but Yossi Weiser, who was raised in the right-wing world, wrote to me, yes, Aguda did not participate, but rather, he said 15 years later, there was a pro-Israel rally in Washington, and he said, Reb Zelig Epstein's yeshiva, Shari Torah from Kew Gardens Hills, they did attend. But you have to understand, Reb Zelig Epstein, who I met on occasion, he was much broader than the right-wing world. He was an enikel to Reb Shimon Shkop, he was a Lamdin Mufak, but he was a free thinker. He didn't allow himself to march to someone else's tune. He was saved from Japan, he went to Canada, and he had a master's. He spoke perfect English. He read the New York Times every day. He was a little different than the run-of-the-mill in what Aguda Yisrael Nebuch, what happened this last 2 weeks after Rip Kriya. It's so sad. Okay. And Rabbi Weiser says, I was at the Soviet rally in 1987, and I went to the Soviet Union a week later. When we showed photos of the rally to refuseniks, they were moved to tears. Quote, you did this for us? It was an amazing event. But the newspapers reported in Russia that there were only 250,000 there, not 1 million. Or well, the newspapers reported anyway. Now, the other point that he makes, which is very, very important, he didn't understand me entirely when I spoke about, many times in class, the Sunday class, the question has come up about gelatin and Reb Chaim Moshe's heta, the Rav was Samach and Reb Chaim Moshe. So, it's not that I said I wonder why people aren't Samach and Reb Chaim Moshe. What I said was, those who wish to, yesha mi l'smoch. I personally don't eat gelatin, and I never ate gelatin, because I grew up in New York, and already by the time I was conscious of what life is about, we had a choice in New York. New York was not Boston, New York was not Detroit, New York was not Cleveland, New York was not even Chicago. In New York already, I remember labeled Spitzky with the kosher cheese on the east side, the Zeifa Tzadik Levracha. Great Jews, great people. You remember Label Bespritsky? You know who he was? Rabbi Rebel's great nephew by marriage. And his store, when you came in Sunday morning, there was a line outside the store. It didn't move quickly because there was a Hasid. He became a Lubavitcher. He was a Lubavitcher from high school. He was the Torah Vadas boy. And when the sixth Rebbe came to America, he was caught up in the frenzy that Lubavitch has arrived in America. And his descendants, as far as I know, are all Lubavitcher. So we had a choice, but here he tells me something that's very sad. He says, you wonder why people don't rely on Reb Chaim Moshe's heta? Well, let me tell you, two of my friends were mashgichim for kosher gelatin plants and left. Simon Ludmer, the same name as Simon Italiano, of the famous Yerushalmi Ludmer family. Anyone, you the old Ludmer matzahs, do you remember? When we came in Aliyah, there was the bakery Ludmer. And Etrogim told me over 30 years ago, he used to be a Rabbanut Mashgiach at the kosher gelatin plant in Belgium. And he was shocked to see the supposedly dry bones of the treif animals, not at all dry, still having meat on them. When he reported this and wasn't happy with the response, he quit and became a very successful businessman. Similarly, Rabbi Fink of Young Israel of New Rochelle, it's also someone I've met over the years, wonderful individual, told me that over 30 years he had gone to check out a kosher gelatin plant in Rhode Island and found the same situation. Bones which were not dry with remnants of meat on them. So perhaps it's not so much opposition to Chaim Moshe as the realization that in practice it is unreliable. And this ultimately leads us into the OU. I was shocked when I came to America 2-3 years ago and every pretzel is OUD. So I called my contacts at the OU. What's going on? How can every pretzel be OUD? There's no milk. What can be in a pretzel? I think if you peel milk in, pardon me, you'll kill the taste of the pretzel. And I found out that all these plants make many products on the same equipment. The OU used the kasha. But they reached the conclusion it's impossible to kosher an industrial setup. The plant, the bakery, the oven, the rubber, the screws. I went into the kitchen of the Waldorf Astoria, and I have to tell you, I don't know how they kosher it.
Which one?
No, in New York, the Waldorf Astoria in New York. The kitchen is like two stories high. The ovens rotate going up and down. How do you kosher all that? And follow? And then an Einu Ben Yoma. How do you get an Einu Ben Yoma? They had a big affair the night before, so you pug them. You put in a little bleach, a little soap powder. Is that really pug them? I don't know. After I saw the caterers happened to be my students, so they let me explore the whole area. Besides the other problems in America, all the hotels are union controlled. You can't come in and work there. If I have an affair, I say, I want Charlie and Morty to be the waiters. I trust them that they'll only bring out from the little area we made kosher. You can't do that. It's their waiters. So you kosher a little area out of a kitchen that's two blocks long. And you put a little fence up, a rope. No, you bring in the regular waiters, not that they're vicious or evil, but automatically they'll pick up a spoon from the other table. I hold it to be a big chisaron in outside of Israel. In Israel, you have to give cover to the rabbinate. that the hotels are kosher or not kosher, but there's no shtick that you can suddenly kosher a hotel. So I understand exactly what he's saying. Okay, let's come back here, and it's a very fascinating shiur today, and I'm going to reach... pass this back to Yitzchak. Yitzchak, take my pen. If I need a pen, I'll borrow from Dov.
Thank you.
A very fascinating shiur. We're going to hit two crescendos. So you see, by 1942 it was obvious you couldn't save any Jews. By 1943 they reached the conclusion you can't work clandestinely, you need the government, you need the whole world behind you. And the big march, and that march is crucial, as I explained last week. No one realizes how much we gained from the failure of the march, meaning the Rav became a religious Zionist, that was the Makabah Patish, and the Kol Dodi Dofek, whatever you read of the last half of the 20th century, nothing equals the Rav's Kol Dodi Dofek. I was there when he gave it, I was there with Malka, we were kids, and I was 56, I already was in Yeshiva College, Malka was graduating Ramaz, and we knew each other from B'nai Akiva, there was already a connection between us, Baruch Hashem. And we were in the audience, and it was the Sheish Tzvikot, it was unreal, the people sitting there. I didn't go in Aliyah right away, simply because I listened to the Rav. The Rav felt, you speak English, you can influence, you know how to teach. My Rav once gave me a big compliment that I excite the students when I teach at Tosfos. All right, that is a compliment. They excite high school age students when you're teaching at Tosfos. That is an achievement. But the Six-Day War became the knock that pushed us over the cliff. But that essay, every kid in Israel, the Mamlachti Dati system, others, it's nothing that the Rav said or wrote has that wide influence like Kol Dodi Dofek, and that's the result of the march. Now, by the end of the war, everything shifts, and what I told you, and I'll prove it to you, and I'll give you sources, everything was helter-skelter. See, when you study this period, 45, 46, 47, you're viewing it as it is today. Shimi, you're going to Torah Shraga. Torah Shraga has a computer printout of every student in the school, right or wrong. Torah Shraga knows where you went to high school. Torah Shraga is organized. The YU office, the Abraham program, they have a computer printout of every kid on the Yeshiva University program and every different school and every girl and every boy and what your background is and where you come from. It's an unbelievable world today because we can be well organized. It works against us too. Simon is a criminal. He's trying to run away from Israel. You can't get anywhere because your name is on the Interpol list. Wherever you come in with your passport, immediately they ring a bell. Within 2 minutes, three guys are pulling you away. Right or wrong? This is the world today. You can't get away with anything. It turned out it's a computer glitch. They corrected it. But for a few weeks, when you came into the United States, when you leave Israel, you leave on an Israeli passport. Right or wrong? That's the law. I'm an Israeli citizen. When I come into America, I'm coming in on an American passport. I don't have a visa. I'm an American citizen. I pay taxes to America yet. Unlike Jack, who pays nothing to Canada. He's lucky stiff. Mm-hmm. But America chokes us. You understand, Simon? I come in, I'm suddenly pulled aside. The computer showed I didn't leave, wherever I left, I didn't leave on my American passport. Right away, I'm suspected of being a criminal. What do you have? What's going on here? You didn't leave on an American passport here. I'm dead serious. This was not a joke. It held me up for an hour. So you have to go on a special line. Then when you get to the lady in charge, she laughs. She says, oh yeah, you're from Israel. Yeah, we know you. Yeah, it's fine. You leave on your Israeli, come in on your American. Now they straightened it out. That glitch has their signs up. If you come in an American passport, even if you left on a different one, you're not held up for an hour. You go on the regular line and they extradite it in accordance with the laws. But after World War II, how do you look? How do you find? And now remember, put yourself in the place of someone who survived. Shimmy, how many siblings do you have?
Six.
You have your family of seven, yeah. Okay? You survive. Where are your siblings? Who's alive? Who's dead? Where do you look for them? Parents. Where are your parents? You follow what I'm saying? And this was a time, there was no computer. So the Red Cross made a list. The Jewish Agency made a list. Ichveis Hayas made a list. Everyone's running around with lists. How reliable is it? Look at the difference between a list made by hand and what the computer does today. There's a law that begins January 1st in Israel. Do you know what's going on, Morty? Are you up to date? The Agudat Yisrael is going crazy. They're taking Gafni's picture, Moshe Gafni, Degel HaTeda, and they're burning it in public. They're throwing darts at his picture. He signed the law. He's chairman of the committee that deals with this in the Knesset. What's the law? Beginning January 1st, anyone buying an apartment, Dove went in and just bought an apartment opposite the King David Hotel for $2 million. All right? Dove walks in. Dove, I'll give you the facts when I want to. It's okay. At least I'm not having you arrested like Simon. I'm giving you $2 million. Be happy. Dove goes in with the... No, I'm serious now. He goes in with $2 million. Fine. Until now, no one asked questions. He gave them a check. The check didn't bounce. $2 million. Fine. Now you have to explain where you got the money from.
Well, it's still that way. I went to a bank, Frankie Good. They said whatever money you want to put in, you have to show where the source of that money is.
Right, but now that's with the banks. Now they extended the law as of January 1st. Anyone buying an apartment, where you got the money. Now, why are they doing that? Why is Agudat Yisrael so upset? Because a lot of the money that comes in from America, England, it's black money, it's laundered money, it's family that they've made money, under the table, and they want to help their family in Israel. Ah, now they're frightened stiff. America has a deal with Israel. Any American citizen, you have to reveal whatever America wants to know about them. I spend over $1,000 a year filing an American. I have to go to an American tax lawyer. I have to show my pension plan here. Have to show my coupon. What the heck does this have to do with America? I'm living here 50 years. But that's the law. I object. I feel terrible that I don't want to wind up in jail. And I got letters. It's not that I couldn't avoid it. I got letters from the bank, from the Kupat Gemel, from my pension plan. You were born in America. We will have to reveal anything and everything about you if the American government requests it. That is the law. That's the treaty. Okay? Today you can do it. But when you're dealing with a Hayas list, a Red Cross list, a United Nations refugee list, a Jewish agency list, everything gets messed up. Now, the Vatat Salah, as you recall last week, immediately sent four great people to Europe, tell us what's going on, among them Shmuel Schmidt, and now they come back and Reb Lazer Suv is getting the reports, and he makes up his mind, and you got to give him all the credit in the world, he's in his 60s, but the man is active. He's a dynamo. He is going to Europe. And I quote to you in the Silvira, page 227, a letter he wrote to Rabbi Israel Rosenberg, who was the second most influential Orthodox rabbi in the United States. He wrote to him, I want to go to Europe, but I'm the president of the Vat Hatzalah. I'm the president of the Agudas HaRabbanim. I want ample funds available so I can do whatever I want in Europe to help the survivors. The minimum in my hands has to be $100,000. Now, he had good contacts. Senator Taft, that was from Ohio, his own state, Cincinnati, Ohio. In addition to Senator Taft, there was a very big Ohev Yisrael in Kentucky, Senator Barkley. It's the name that you read about, Alben Barkley, A-L-B-E-N. He was a tremendous Ohev Yisrael, and they loved Reb Lazer Silver. Whatever the reasons were, Reb Lazer was a character. He was alive. I met him on two occasions, but I knew his family intimately. I knew people who knew him. I did a lot of research on Reb Lazer. He was a little guy. He was all of 5'4", but he was the spark of the party. When he walked into a room, everything centered around Reb Lazer. These people were anxious to help, and they were Hasidei Umat Olam. So they got the Senate to pass the law, whatever had to be done, technically making Reb Lazer a member of the United States Army, which entitled him to wear an army uniform. Murray, have you seen my work on Reb Lazer Silver, the Silver Era? It has gone through 4 editions already. It's the most famous work I ever published, although I would wish the Rub should be more famous, etc. But the Silver Era is all over. It's been accepted in the right-wing world as well. Have you ever seen the volume? You know what's on the cover? It's a silver cover with a picture of Reb Lazer Silver in his army uniform, 1946. That was the picture the family said to me. That was the highlight of his life. That was Ein Lach Adam Shein Lo Sha'ah. There's a moment in your life, Shimi, where you achieve the ultimate achievement. You can ask Rabbi Reuben. He may tell you the highlight of his life was when he and Judy were dancing at Kazatska in Red Square while the communists were watching. You follow? When we look back at our lives, that was a great moment, what we achieved, what we did there. This was the highlight of his life. So he now has an army uniform. That army uniform becomes very important because it offers him protection, as you will see. In addition, he did something which Malka and I emulated many years later. The money, well over $100,000 in cash, a fortune of money in small bills that had to be distributed, not $1 bills, but I would imagine $5, $10, $20, not $100 bills, was sewn in. You open up the lining of the coat, and the money was sewn in. That's how he transported the money. Now, Eti, why do I say Malka and I emulated this? The first time we went to Russia, and I have to be honest, people say you had to be brave to do this, do that. Yeah, we had to be brave, but we were frightened out of our wits. You follow? The first time you go in. My friend, who I spoke about yesterday, Tzvi Groner, never got over the trauma of his first trip to Russia. I got over it, but we were frightened. Now we have all these names. It's a limit what you want to memorize. And you're worried stiff they'll confiscate the address book. The truth is they didn't confiscate. They took the address book away and they Xeroxed it. They gave it back to you a half hour later, then they Xeroxed. Yes,
it's I read the Stamatskis, and I got myself a crossword puzzle book.
Right.
And I used that.
Right. We all figured out shtick. I had an old type of little hand computer, something very primitive. No one knows how to tell you how to get me the information today. I put it in, whatever. But what we really did was we opened up the lining of the coat, Mark opened it up, and with indelible ink, wrote in on the very inside names, phone numbers. And Baruch Hashem re-sewed it and never had a problem. And we learned that from Reb Lazer Silver. Now, the day finally comes, and 1946, March, he sails for Europe. And the Agudat Yisrael hosts a farewell reception for him in New York. The next day, I shouldn't say sails, he flies overseas for the first time in his life. A 17-hour flight, it's before jets, propellers. He arrives in Amsterdam. Amsterdam, who else has come in from Israel? And remember, none of this was coordinated. It's not like today where you can contact an instant communication and coordinate. It's a different world today. You have to realize that when you do your research, Don't be anachronistic. Don't try to understand 46 in the light of 2019. You follow? So he meets Rav Herzog in Amsterdam. He had come in, the chief rabbi, came in with a whole entourage, including his son, Yaakov David, including Rabbi Zev Gold, and they planned the trip. You'll go here, I'll go there. They shouldn't overlap. And Reb Lazer, you have no idea this man is going from... And by the way, the Holland community, about 80% of the Kehila was wiped out. They had, I think it was even higher than the Polish loss. And the reason the Dutch community was so easy to wipe out, they were adjacent to Germany. And if you know Holland, they're like the Germans, Yekkers, very medayek. So in City Hall, they had a list of every citizen and what his religion was. So within one day, they could round up every Jew. You couldn't hide. They knew who was Jewish. Poland, a Catholic family could take you in and hide you. All right, they risked their lives, but there were Hasidei Umat Olam who did it. And the Holland community was decimated. From there, he went to Belgium. From there, he went to Paris. From there, he went to Czechoslovakia. From there, he finally goes to Poland. Poland, of course, is the most important place to be because that's where you had the greatest amount of Jews who were killed and who survived, because the Polish community was a very, very large Jewish community. The Jews were one-tenth of the Polish population. While he's traveling around on the trains, going from Kehila to Kehila, where they're Jews, where they're survivors, he sees people are staring at him one day in Poland, and there's enmity in their eyes, but they're baffled by the fact that he has a United States Army uniform on him. That basically saved his life. He later found out that that day was the Kiltz program, pogrom, if I'm pronouncing Kiltz right.
Kiltz,
you pronounce it? Okay. Now, the Kiltz pogrom is a very fascinating story, and its influence cannot be denied on the future history of the refugee population. And here we come back to Shimi. Shimi has survived. He has, you see, a beautiful family, six siblings. Parents, where are they? What are they? Maybe I got to go back to where I come from. Who can think of going on to Israel? Who can think of Palestine at the time? Who can think America? I survived. Let me go back home. And many Jews who survived were caught. What do we do, La'an? What is further? And Shimi found out that this sister survived, this brother survived, all right? Not everyone was wiped out. Let's start all over. I know the language. I know the community. I know the bank. I know how where my shul was, where my mikveh was. In other words, look at it like a human being. Many Jews thought, let's go back. We have no choice. We'll start all over. This pogrom that the Poles wiped out, I have the figure in here, I'll reach it in a few minutes. It was, I believe, if I recall, over 120 Jews were massacred. Imagine to survive the Hitler, to survive the concentration camps, the death camps, to survive all that they went through, and then to be killed by your own Polish neighbors. And that event was the Makkabe Patish. Anyone who had seichel, we're going in Aliyah, we're going to America, we're leaving Europe, there is no future in Europe, we're going into DP camps, which became a stepping stone for where you would go later, but we have to get out of here. And that day they could have killed Reb Lazer Silver. He's on a Polish train all by himself, he didn't travel with anyone. Not a guy with a beard, obviously Jewish, But wearing a uniform of the United States Army, it saved his life. And that's...
Did he ever have to ask the American Army for protection?
You're asking a good question. I don't know why he didn't. I don't know if they could have. It could be he felt the less attention he attracts to himself, the better off he is. But he survived. He got to Lodz. He got to Krakow. And then Katowice. He was all over. And then finally he's in Poland, Warsaw again, has a meeting with the heads of the Polish government. The meeting was supposed to be on Friday, and the meeting was called off and delayed for one day to Shabbos. Why was it called off? That Friday was the pogrom in Kielce. That Friday. And Shabbos, now problems with Shabbos. So Friday, he left all his documents at the Polish embassy or the Polish office, where he was going to have the meeting on Shabbos. Shabbos morning, he heads for the location, and here he's accompanied by Mrs. Recha Sternbuch. This is from the famous Switz family that played such a role with the government and Bar Hatzala, and this was a lady, Gdola Mirabban Shema. A world-class lady, the Sternberg family, many people living in Israel, they're interrelated with the Soloveitchik family today, and they meet with the head people, the president of the new Polish government, and I have here the whole speech that Silva makes, telling him, let my people go, let the Jews go, they've gone through so much hell, torture, death. Don't let them suffer further. And remember, you're dealing with a Polish government that is being taken over by the communists. Silva's plea becomes very, very important. It spares these Jews from being persecuted. Anyone who could get out, the Polish government allowed them. They were not like the Russians, who were much more mockpit, much more careful, much more, I would say, nitpitting who they allowed out. You had to prove you were Polish and not Russian to begin with. Here they let them out. A lot had to do with Silva's meeting. From there he goes on to Czechoslovakia. And here you have the one country that was pro the Jews, help the Jews, a country that is pro-Jewish, pro-Israel until this very moment. And here it's also a sad story. He meets with the foreign minister, John Masaryk, if I'm pronouncing John right, J-A-N. Correct me if I'm wrong. How do you pronounce it?
Jan.
Jan.
All the
J's are Y's. Jan Masaryk. He is the son of the first president of modern Czechoslovakia, Thomas Masaryk. If you recall, Thomas Masaryk was an Ohev Yisrael. His son inherited his ability, and Jan Masaryk did everything in his power to help replace the silver, to help the Jews. The sad part of the story is that the communists ultimately take over Czechoslovakia too, and 2 years later they execute Masaryk. And this goes on all over. We spoke about it last week with Wallenberg, and it repeats itself thousands of times over. Not only Jews, Gentiles as well, but Jews and Gentiles who cooperate with the communists, and then the communists suspect they're traitors, and Stalin and the paranoia, and they execute millions of people wholesale. Not only Jews. Here you can't say the communists were anti-Semitic. They were anti any human being who didn't march and puppet their ideology word by word. Now, While all this is going on, rumors are spreading in America, the Vahatzala has done its share, its life is over, what do we need Vahatzala for? It becomes a little bit harder fundraising, and this is inevitable. The war is over. People, it's like the issue of Russian Jewry. Russian Jewry, when we were growing up, the 50s into the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, this was an absolute major issue. Today when I speak and try to raise funds for Shvut Ami, people look at you, Russian Jews, what's the problem? What's going on? They're safe, they're fine, they're good, they want to be good Jews, fine, they don't want to be good Jews, give them freedom of choice, no difference than any Israeli citizen, American Jewish citizen, everyone has freedom of choice. And Reb Blazer was very powerful, sending back press releases, sending back stories, sending back incidents, people he met, survivors. People should know Vahatzala still has a major job to do. Finally, he goes to Germany. Germany, you have to understand, the greatest amount of survivors were in Germany, were in the displaced person camps, basically controlled by the Americans. There were others controlled by the British. You all know how they divided up the responsibility in Germany. And he crosses over into Germany. And here he really sees what is happening, who the survivors are, what they're going through. And he reaches Frankfurt on the Main, which, if you recognize the city, this is where Rav Hirsch created Neo-Orthodoxy. This is where Charlie Hexter's roots come from. He reaches Frankfurt on the Main. And who do you think is the American Jewish chaplain of the American Army stated in Frankfurt on the Main? One of Rabbi Rubin's, no, he was out already. He was elsewhere. One of Rabbi Rubin's biggest heroes, Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Rachman. Now, Rabbi Rachman and Rabbi David Silva, the son of Reb Blazer, who went into the rabbinate and followed his father's lead, they were classmates from Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Chanan in the 1920s. And here's a letter that Rabbi Rachman writes to his colleague, Rabbi David Silver, dated August 8, 1946. Your father arrived here Monday and left last night. I did all I could to make him comfortable. But how your mother couldn't force him to stay in the States is beyond me. By the way, when he says how your mother, it's referring to Reb Blazer's second wife, who raised the children, basically. She was Taka, a mother to them. His first wife died young. There were four children, and she died young. He is living on Torah, not food. He is lecturing beyond the capacity of any five humans half his age. He said that he fared better out Zelzelsheim than any other camp he visited. But as luck would have it, half the time he was there, he fasted. In other words, kosher food was available there, but he was fasting. The few little things I was able to do for him made me very happy. But I was worried, as well as inspired, by his enterprise and locomotion. And he may come via Frankfurt again in a week, but I pray that he doesn't go to Palestine and goes home instead for a rest. Well, nothing would stop Reb Blazer. He continued the journey, visited the survivors, the British, the Russian zones, went for Germany to Austria, toured Vienna, and then went on to Italy. And in Italy, there was a yeshiva established. Again, all this was helter-skelter. It was not centrally organized. It couldn't be. Here there was a yeshiva. Here there was kosher food. Here there wasn't. Here there was a mikveh. Here there wasn't. Here there was Chabad. Here there wasn't. But in Italy, there was a yeshiva, Ma'ar HaTorah, and there's a beautiful story. And this was a yeshiva organized by the survivors with the aid of Vahatzala. And Reb Lazer came to the yeshiva, and here he sees little Jewish kids studying. Oh. He kissed every young pupil as if kissing a Torah scroll. He announced the prize of $50 for every student who had mastered 25 folio pages of the Talmud. One youngster told the guest that he did not yet have the ability to study Talmud, but he did know 25 chapters of Tehillim. He was also granted the full sum by Rabbi Silva. It's a beautiful story. You have to understand the feeling that these were kids, that they're survivors, that they're Jewish children. Abe Foxman tells the story that after the war, his survival in one of the DP camps, they would put him on the shoulder and were dancing that there's a Jewish kid who's left. Torah has a future. And this was the feeling, a beautiful story, this young child.
But,
in Italy, in Rome. Italy, interestingly enough, the closer you came to the Vatican, the better they treated the Jews. It's amazing. The Catholic Church in Poland was so anti-Semitic that they could kill every Jew they could get their hands on. And until today we have problems with the Catholic Church in Italy, in Poland. But in Italy, it's amazing. There they received the Jews. There were popes and there were Italian clergy who risked their lives to save Jews. And they did everything possible after World War II to help. And that's where this yeshiva was. But the most famous story is when Silva arrives this story is told time and again. If you look into Silva, you'll get the source. I cite it word by word, where he comes to this DP camp and he meets Simon Wiesenthal. Now, Simon Wiesenthal was already famous as one of the most active survivors, doing and yelling and shouting, and he was someone, Kofetz LaRoche, who took leadership position. And here he's in this DP camp, and they're going to dedicate a Sefer Torah on Sunday. And the word goes out that the most famous survivor, the activist, Simon Wiesenthal, is not going to come to the dedication. So Reb Lazer meets him. Classic story. Reb Lazer meets him and he tells him, Simon Wiesenthal says, in April of 1945, a train from Hungary arrived at the Mauthausen death camp, where Simon Wiesenthal was interned. One of the newcomers succeeded in smuggling a small prayer book. Wiesenthal, at first, greatly admired that individual. What courage! They would catch him, he would be dead. The admiration soon turned to dismay when Wiesenthal observed this man lending his prayer book to other inmates for 15 minutes apiece in return for a quarter of each person's daily soup ration. All right. Now, Silva didn't know the story. He arrives, brings in the Torah scroll. It was sent from America. It was caught up with him. The Van Hatzalah arranged it. Silva asked for it. And Silva encountered Wiesenthal. And this, I'm now quoting Simon Wiesenthal. That night, Rabbi Silva came to see me. He was a small man who wore an American Army uniform. He had a small white beard and his bright eyes shone with great kindness. He must have been at least 75, but his mind was sharp, his voice was youthful. He told me he had been born in the Ukraine, the country of pogroms, and had emigrated as a boy to America, the country of hope. He put his hands on my shoulder. So they tell me, you're angry with God, he said in Yiddish, and smiled at me. I said, not with God, but with one of his servants, and told him what had happened. He kept smiling. And that's all you have to tell me? Isn't that enough, Rabbi, I asked? Du Duma, you silly man, he said. So you look only at the bad man who took something from the good ones? Why don't you look instead at the good man who gave something to the bad one? He touched me with his outstretched palm and left. I went to the service the next day. Ever since then, I have tried to remember there are two sides to every problem, although sometimes it is as difficult to see as the other side of the moon. By the way, that became the title of one of Wiesenthal's books, if you recognize it, The Other Side of the Moon, The Conversation with Reb Lazer Silver. I quoted this and re-quoted. I don't have to quote Reb Lazer, Simon Wiesenthal, but I quote because it's in print. The family, everyone that knew him, this story was told and retold. I've used it so many times, even this last week. If you're aware what's going on. So some of my grandchildren, you know, the Aguda, the Degelatayra, the fighting. Now I always tell them, why do you look at the bad deeds of people? Look at the good deeds. I hate to say it, but I say to them, look at your grandfather. Your Sabu. You have any complaints about me? You know me all your life. You know me intimately. Don't tell me about the bad people. And they know the story, the Reb Lazer Silver story, all my grandchildren can repeat. But it's a very, very powerful insight. People can be good, people can be bad. That's life, that's the way God made the world. If we would all be good, there'd be no room for Torah, no room for mitzvot, no room for Schar Va'onish. You're all familiar with Hilchat Shuvah. All of us have perfect choice. But look at the good. Don't look at the evil, the bad, the stupidity. And it hurts that, you know, to bring the whole machloket to America. You don't realize what's going on now, what they're doing to the Novominska. Oh, wow. It is sad. But these are human beings. We can't change the world. This is why Rakefet has said a million times over, and here I'm correct, not 250,000, but a million times over, Hasidus conquered the world. The Musa movement, if from the time of Yisrael began in 1840 in Vilna, if there are 1,000 Musaniks in the world, I'm overstating the case. Musa makes demands. You have to upgrade your lifestyle, your thinking, your decency, positivism. Chassidus, it's wonderful, but to be a simple chassid, all you have to have is the ability to drink a l'chaim on Yutet Kislev. You're already a chassid. There are chassidim, Gedolei Yisrael, I don't deny it, but to reach the minimal, and you know my stories at 770, when we pushed the chassid aside and the guy turned on us, my Talmud Dr. Normie Go was with us, so you don't have to believe me. But we all, whenever we get together, we retell the story and laugh again. And this guy turned on us. We were pushing to get up close to the Rebbe, and the guy turned on us and cursed us out. It's like a sale of what? American curse words, cuss words. Wow. Guy probably was a sailor who became a Baal Tshuva. But he didn't lose that ability to curse. But a Musanik wouldn't curse. But this is a Meridic story. That's one high point of today's lecture. But there's a second high point. And here you have to ask yourself a simple question. When your life is shattered, do you have the ability to go further? And not everyone had this ability. People are still in homes in Israel paid for by Germany who never were able to recover from the Holocaust. And we'll come back. You survive. Your wife is dead. Your children are dead. You are happily married. You're not one of these people. Remember I told you about the RCA convention when the Rav mourned his wife. So don't ask what went on afterwards in the hallway. I can just see it. And one rabbi is like dancing. If my Macha Schaefer would die, I'll dance a kazatska on her grave. I couldn't believe my ears. But it shows you his marriage and his concept of his wife. All right, the Rav had a different type of marriage. So how do you start all over? You lost your wife, you lost your children. Some people were able to do it. And here, Reb Lazer, I document this story, but there are endless stories like this. He gave out money. They came to Reb Lazer, this $100,000, went a long way. People, well, we have relatives in America, we're corresponding with them, they hope to get us a visa. Reb Lazer, do you have any money? No, we have no money. How do we get there? How do we... spending money, whatever, we'll get the ticket from the Jewish agency, let's say, or Hayas, whoever's responsible, the Red Cross. Oh, we'd give them a $20 bill. But before he gave them the money, he made a condition. They have to remarry and start all over again. And you can imagine a person who lost his wife and children. How can I start all over? How can I remarry? A woman who lost her husband, children. No, you have to overcome it for the good of the Jewish people. And there were many stories where they remarried, had children. And Reb Lazer was the sandik at the Brit in America of the child that was born. Many stories of people he remained in touch with. Bar mitzvah, children, his encouragement. You have to, not everyone can do this, but many could. And here I'll tell you a true story, B'didenu HaVyuvna, right here in Yerushalayim. So I live in Rav Chaim Berlin 18. The building was built 50 years ago, right after the Six-Day War. And I'm from the original occupants of the building. Not everyone is alive today. It's a building that you could write a book about, who has lived there, the greatest Rabbanim, tens and tens of Svarim, hundreds perhaps, were either written or edited by the Rabbanim living in the building. So quite a few years ago, a lady buys the apartment next to mine, Chana Stein, Zichrona Levracha. And she's a survivor, and we get to know her. Rabbi Hutner, my third floor neighbor, my distinguished neighbor, Rabbi Yoshua Hutner, very friendly with her. And we get to know the story. She comes from Romania. Her father was president of the Mizrahi. Happily, she was happily married, had children. Everyone was killed, only she survived. Threw the whole religion away. You can't blame her. You can't argue with her. But she went through. I've told you more than once when I grew up in the shul I daven, the Yeshivat Rabbeinu Chaim Moser, there was one man who came to Minyan morning and night, a survivor, and it was rumored that his wife, whenever she made chicken soup, she poured in half a cup of milk. So I once asked the rabbi, why don't we say something to him? And he said to me, you're an American kid, you don't understand where they were, what they went through, what they saw. We can't say a word to them. And I learned a fabulous lesson from that rabbi. I think I remember his name, but I'm not certain because there were a number of rabbis there, one after another. So she remarried a survivor who lost his first wife and children, and they had two children integrated on the Israeli scene. And we would meet them occasionally, nice children, but seemed not to know anything about Yiddishkeit or very little about Yiddishkeit. Typical kids raised here with a secular education. And I had a number of conversations with her. She would tell me about her father, about the Mizrahi, but she would never accept an invitation for Sudat Shabbat. Rabbi Kuttner would invite her constantly because he was in her age range, and his wife, the Tzadeket, Batsheva Soloveitchik Kuttner, Zichrona Livracha, never accepted an invitation, and she lived her life. And nothing you can say, nothing you can do. But you see, you can run away from God, but ultimately, He catches you. Met her granddaughter, nice girl, in pants, graduates high school, Tel Aviv, and she's in the Israeli army. And I see she's in the army. She's wearing pants, comes to visit her grandmother, which is good. I mean, a secular family, but at least they have feeling for her grandmother. You follow? Generally, you see among the Haredim and the Dapim, there's much more feeling, the Hasidim. But no, the girl had their inheritance for her grandmother. And then I notice a year or two later, she's come to visit her grandmother. She's in the army. She's wearing a skirt. And then she's bringing a young man to her grandmother. Big kippah sruga, beard, tzitzit and droysin outside. And they marry. They're living happily ever after. Children. And I said to the grandmother, she's resuscitated your parents and their commitments. And the grandmother agreed with me. I didn't want to go further. I didn't want to tell her this is the secret of our survival. Without this, we can't survive. Without Torah mitzvah, the Pooh report, the Shmoo report, what's going on in America, how to do, what to do. All we have to do is Shabbos, Kashrut, and Torah Mishpacha. And you become a Jew. You become a total Jew. But what a beautiful story. Do you want the other side of the story? Whenever I would ride up with her, whenever I would meet her, he would look at me. Should we go back now to what I said an hour ago with Richie Friedman, Dr. Friedman? I still can't get over it. Go back to Richie, and she would meet me, and Mashlumcha Mara Kefet. Now, no one calls me Mara Kefet. Everyone calls me Aaron, Ani, depending how long they know me. Or Harav Rakefet, all right? I don't need titles, but to call me Mar Rakefet, Mr. Rakefet. But I don't blame her. She looks at what I look like. A shegetz, a noisvav, a trumpenik, a pushtak. It's Mar Rakefet. Fine, fine, fine. You won't believe this. Every story I tell is absolutely true. What I have seen in life makes a Hollywood movie look boring. And my wife and I suffer because we like to watch something good, but it's so stupid what we have seen. All right, fine. I get a call from a very prominent multimillionaire. Okay, I don't want to mention the name. I get a call. I didn't make a bracha, right? Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam she'kol mi'yabed v'ra'ol. Very wealthy. And his youngest son, being bar mitzvah, would like me to officiate at the great synagogue, speak, putting us up in the hotel across the street, the plaza. And, I've lost the Yetzer Hara. This is the dream of every rabbi. To officiate one day at the great synagogue in Jerusalem. But at my, even then, even it must be 10 years ago already, I don't know how long ago, but whatever. I lost my Yetzer Hara in Lower Merion Synagogue back in 1961. It's a fact. But, and I don't want to do anything Shabbos because I teach Sunday, I teach Monday, and I don't have a microphone Shabbos. And this microphone enables me to teach till I'll be 240 years old, Be'ezrat Hashem. And I have what to teach until then. So I asked my eldest daughter. She knows the family. I thought each one of my daughters was involved in terrific chesed work. So I asked her, should I go? She says, Abba, you have to go. He's done some very good things for victims of Arab terror, etc. All right, And there's a reason why he had to ask me. I don't want to elaborate, but the answer is very simple. I figured it out. He has in his family a very prominent rabbi who's, not the chief rabbi, someone else who stood trial. He hadn't yet stood trial. And the great synagogue would not allow him to officiate. They said if he's found innocent, he's innocent. But kol zman, there's no verdict, he cannot officiate. So he turned to me. He kenned me from the Vikings. He knows me from distantly, but he knows me. So I said yes. And we went. And I have to tell you, these people have money. They took the building on Achara Am, built by the Reichmans. They turned the downstairs into a medieval reception hall. The decorations, the kain gold, kain silver, the food, unbelievable. And I'm the only rabbi there, and they're giving me covered malachim, and I'm speaking at every meal, and you won't believe it. My next door, Dave, and the money there. There were diamond dealers from Belgium, and diamond dealers from Paris, and diamond dealers from Jerusalem, and the women, just look what's on their fingers. They're walking banks, I'll put it that way. It's, wow. And believe it or not, my next door neighbor is married to the son of one of the leading members of this family. And there she is sitting there. And there's Mara Kefet. And suddenly everyone, Haravra Kefet, Haravra Kefet. And I'm introduced with such stories and titles and this and that. And she hears me speak. And Rebbeinu Shalom, take my word for it, the Mar disappeared. And it became Harav Rakefet. And boy, what happens in life, indescribable. Now, back here, that story with that individual multiplied by tens, twenties, 100 times over. You can't put a price on what Reb Lazer accomplished. And this is the most basic message of life. My grandmother taught me this in the early 50s. A first cousin of mine died. He was born challenged, and he lived. The family lived with my grandmother in their house. She was very attached to him. And he died about the age of two. There were blood problems. The parents, one kid from that family survived, and he's a fine individual. I wish he would discover Yiddishkeit, marry children, a little bit Yiddishkeit, but not what we want, not what will save us as Jews. So when we came back from the funeral, I'll never forget, my grandmother said to me, "Ein zach v'lech eis ochle." I was already an MTA, I already knew something. "One thing I want to teach you, the Lebendike Dafkein Vaita. We who survive have to go further. This is a very difficult challenge. Some of us can do it. The majority can do it. If we have a healthy outlook, a good mental outlook. But Reb Lazer gets all the credit. And just think what I told you. He's laid a sandek at Britut of kids who were born from parents who with difficulty remarried, but went further. By the way, all the memoir literature that comes up in the Holocaust, and I need not tell you, there are literally thousands of books. I just saw the catalog of Yad Vashem. I'm giving it to my, later today I'm doing a chesed. I have to leave on time today. We're going to visit Mrs. Miriam Baumel. Recognize the name? It's her son, Zach Baumel, who's been missing from 1982. So my family is going to this, one of my daughters, again, Chesed, to wish her happy Hanukkah and to be with her and my wife. And that daughter has done a lot of work on Holocaust literature, so I'm giving her the latest catalog. Thousands of books are available, but this theme comes up time and again. The people who remarried, and 50, 60 years later, they're privileged to see 10 and 10 and tens of direct children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And what do they say? Das uns in der Koma from Hitler. This is our revenge from Hitler. Now, very interestingly, from Europe, he goes on to Palestine. And here, tired, ragged, run down. He's like resuscitated. Arrives in the Holy Land in August 1946 and immediately goes to Yerushalayim and davens at the Kotel. And Friday night is the first time that he eats in someone's home. Reb Lezer Silva, you know the stories. Whenever he traveled, by the time he was a world-class person and traveling, it was his second wife. She was very organized. And I've heard this description not just from his children, from people that he were embarrassed that he came to their home and he didn't eat. He came to homes of famous rabbis. And she would wrap for him a sandwich and mark it Monday, another sandwich, Tuesday, Wednesday. They took out his food. He was very skinny, but that's the way he ate. Whose home did he eat on Friday night in Yerushalayim? The Briska Rav. He went to see the Briska Rav, Rav Velvel. Rav Velvel, of course, was the son of Rav Chaim. He studied in his youth with Rav Chaim in Brisk, and with the Brisk Rav, there were no shtick. Not to eat in his home, that would have been an embarrassment for the Brisk Rav. And that's where Rav Velvel, that's where Rav Silva ate. But not just the Brisk Rav. He basically in Yerushalayim met with all the Rabbanim. He helped organize and charge and restart and ignite Var HaTzala, the Var HaYeshiva. Remember I mentioned this? In Palestine, you need a Var HaYeshiva like you had in Europe. He helped spark it. He brought Rabbi Reuven Katz of Petach Tikvah. He brought Rabbi Tukachinsky and Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, Rabbi Chil Michal Tukachinsky, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. He got them all involved, and he gave shiurim in all the yeshiva that existed at that time. The most prominent of all the yeshiva was Hebron, the Hebron yeshiva in the heart of Yerushalayim at the time, not in Givat Mordechai. And everyone knew this is Reb Lezer, this is the Var HaTzala, this is the Agudas HaRabbanim, this is a man who can raise millions of dollars if need be. The kavod, the derech eretz, the understanding, it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. And in his final talk in Hebron Yeshiva, when he finished his final shiur in Yerushalayim, he said the greatest joy he has in his trip is seeing the yeshivat in Palestine. Lo alman Yisrael. He spoke about Yavna v'chachameh. Tainli Yavna v'chachameh. And remember, at this time, the European yeshivat wiped out. The Hasidic world in Europe wiped out. In the United States, what do you have? Yeshivas with Chalchanan, Teira v'das. There was nothing else. And how big were they? What was the level? And here you had in Palestine, Hebron, Eitz Chaim, Sfat Emet, Chassidic yeshivas already. It was a new world. Mir had started up already. No one would dream that Mir would ultimately achieve 6,000-7,000 students. You need a map to walk around Mir today and find who you're looking for, to find the chabur you're looking for. What's the last name?
Arieli,
that's the name I'm looking for. Ravash Arieli, the son of Reb Yitzchak Arieli, the grandson of Reb Yitzchak Arieli. They say he is the biggest chabur in Mir. What do they say? They say during the week 1,000 people hear him in various shiurim, but you have no idea. They shiur him there in English, in Hebrew, in French, in Russian, in Yiddish. Mir, talking about Mir. What else? In Yiddish. He's an Israeli through and through. His grandfather was a Talmud Chaver Mufak of Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. And Rav Silva spoke in terms, this was his greatest nachat. There is life, there is Torah. We are continuing. Who could dream what would be today in 2019? Hundreds of thousands of young people are studying Shasam Paiskim. Take Israel, take America. Those two centers are right. You have elsewhere. You have in Australia, you have South Africa. You have a little bit in England. It's amazing. England never became a major, major Torah center. And they say the reason is that England is so close to Israel that anyone who wants to really study on a high level gets on the plane, and within 3 hours, he's in Bnei Brak, or he's in Yerushalayim, or he's in some yeshivat hezda. But what we have today, there are more people studying Torah than ever before in the history of the Jewish people. The second part of the question is, what is the level? And that is open. We still have not achieved what was in Eastern Europe in the Litvishi Yeshiva. We still have a way to go with all that we have. But this was Reb Lazer. This was the trip. He gets back to the United States on a military plane arranged by the senators, army uniform. You know the way the military planes fly, the higher the rank, if there's an opening on a plane, am I right, Yitzchak? Right. You get a seat, that's it, you're on. And he qualified, came back, the plane landed in Springfield, Massachusetts. From there, he went on to Cincinnati. The papers described him, haggard appearance, lost 35 pounds while overseas. Who was the only country to acknowledge his return? Not Poland, not Germany, Czechoslovakia. The ambassador to the United States sent him a beautiful letter welcoming him back to America and telling him that Czechoslovakia will continue the traditional concept of respect for the Jewish people that began with Masaryk, and never within a year or two the communist takeover, and all these promises weren't worth the paper they were written on. Finally, I'll make one more point today. Reb Lazer returned. Now he knew firsthand what's going on in Europe, what the situation is, what can be done, how to organize it. And once again, Dr. Shmuel Schmidt goes to Europe for the next part, most of the next year. His wife was a tzaddikit, and here I'll explain to you who the Schmidts were and what we're talking about. And this is what life has taught me. I couldn't say this 60 years ago, but my life experience, very simple conclusion. If we would be non-Jews, all we are personalities on a private individual. President Bush died, whatever his religion was, some sort of Protestant religion, that's it. It's an American individual person. His religious commitment ends with his own body. It doesn't go beyond it. We Jews have a dual existence. We're individuals, and we're part of Klal Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Bnei Yisrael. We bring a Korban Pesach together. We have obligations, both as individuals and both as part of Klal Yisrael. The whole concept of a minyan, he stresses that every day, three times a day. Now, the question is, in life, what's more important? Your commitment as a Jew, as an individual, or your commitment to the totality of Jewish existence? Tonight in Teaneck, in Lawrence, in Beverly Hills, tens of thousands of Jews are going to be lighting Hanukkah candles. And yours truly, and Charlie, and Morty, we're all going to ask the same question, though. Why aren't they here? They're good Jews. They read Pashat Lech Lecha. They're committed. The answer is very simple. The individuality of their Jewish existence is worth more than the totality of peoplehood experience. And when they make the cheshbon, they're comfortable in Teaneck, they're happy in Teaneck, they have a home on Rehov Radak or Rehov Lazarov, all over where I live. I meet students of mine from Teaneck with second homes, Lawrence, second homes in your area too. People have second homes. One of them came to class from Highland Park, or East Brunswick, I should say, right or wrong. But where are they living? And everyone faces this question. As I've told you many times, when I send people to Russia, people risk their lives. I don't want to minimize it. I send people to communist Russia. Then they came back. And it was amazing to see where they would be a few months later. There were some people, and again I use the late Judy Rubin, her whole life changed. She couldn't get Russia out of her mind. Jews are in trouble. Jews are in suffering. What can I do to help? And that's because her commitment to the totality was greater than her individuality. You with me, Yitzchak? This is an apt description. And we who came in Aliyah, there are people sitting in this room who I know their own life story. Our commitment to the totality was much more than the individuality. Reb Shmuel Schmidt from Reb Lazer Silver, and never forget that story I told you that haunts me, because I'm a total failure. People know me for years and they didn't become one drop more from, one drop Shemesh Shabbos. I'm a failure. But Reb Chaim Moshe said to Dr. Schmidt, Reb Shmuel, can I call you Reb Shmuel? He broke down and cried. And he said his whole life changed from that one sentence of Reb Chaim Moshe to him. The totality was much more important than the individuality for him and his wife. And what they did cannot be forgotten. He was Moshe Nefesh. He was the man of Bar Hatzalah in Europe. Went back, and then went back again, and stayed almost for an entire year. And that's what Reb Lazer accomplished. That's the Bar Hatzalah. Now, I haven't finished. I have one more volume to open for you. I just want you to feel, I want to take memoir literature, and I chose, out of the thousands of books, I chose one because it's very close to my heart. The people involved, the Torah involved, and the accomplishment. And we'll hit that 2 weeks from today, and it'll open your eyes. It'll be a source that you'll treasure. It opens your eyes. And memoir literature is very important because it doesn't lie. You follow? If I give a lecture on Rabbi Soloveitchik, so a guy can pop up, and people have said this to me, you're an idiot. The Rav was not a Rosh Hashiva, he was a philosopher. You follow? And people will be angry at me. You're portraying the Rav incorrectly. All right, you have a right to have. I criticized you, you criticized me, Zaman Sankerson. But if I write a book of memoir literature, there's nothing there is incorrect, because it's the way I felt, the way I saw it, the way I lived it. You can read Washington, you can't argue with Washington. That's the way this little kid, Ani Rothkopf, understood life. I'm telling facts. That's what makes memoir literature so important. So I want to end off, and then we move on from the Bar Hatzalah to post-World War II orthodoxy. Simon, those shayurim you don't get in just walking in with a smile. $99,000 linked to the shekel on the IOU list. Prepared or not? Baruch Hashem. We have confidence in the Rebbe. All right, let me reiterate. What do we do today? We've practically finished out the Bar Hatzalah, the reconstruction. The high points are two important lessons. The story with Simon Wiesenthal, which is a legendary story. The other side of the moon. And if that's so important for life. Shimi, are you going to teach Torah? Do me a favor, when you teach Torah, explain this to your students. And don't let them be negative and don't let them be critical. Look at the good. Stress the positive. You with me? Shem Yirachem, what's going on now, all the machleket. We're better than they are. We don't want machloket. We understand there can be different viewpoints. We learn Shas and Poskim. You know how many different viewpoints there are? Did you ever open up Midrashic literature? I once asked Rabbi Yosef Weiss, 10 different opinions in a Bereshit Rabba. Who's right? So he answered me, they're all right. At the time, I laughed. He was right. That's a fabulous answer. They're all right. What are we fighting over? There are 12 million Jews in the world who don't know what Shabbos is about. And we're fighting in the... God. It hurts. It hurts me. Because I love Torah. I have no other value in life outside of Torah. All right. That's an important lesson, the other side of the moon. The other one is the ability to rebuild. Don't minimize that. I have had so many students over the decades, over the generations, whose grandparents, parents, remarried against logic, but for the good of the Jewish people. Don't forget what I told you, communal commitment, individual commitment. All right. Be'ezrat Hashem, next week there are no classes. It is Hanukkah. We pick up again in 2 weeks from now. I wouldn't miss the Sunday class for all the money in Fort Knox. And I wouldn't miss the next Monday class for all the rice in China. Now, let me just give out. You won't believe what I have. I have to be brief now because, as I said, I have to join family in doing a big chesed. I want you to know poor Rabbi Zev Lev has been criticized. This is a whole kuntris on whether you're allowed to go to a sock again. I love it. And here is his defense in his own words. I have to tell you, my own opinion is he went to a soccer game. What the heck does he know about soccer? He was raised in Florida. He's a baseball fan. He went to be with his grandchildren and to bring cover to Israel that was playing Scotland. Don't criticize him, but he sat there learning Vasfashteta from a soccer game. All right, I love it, I love it. The student who sent it to me apologized, no apology necessary. America, bless God, a Thanksgiving sermon by Rabbi Nachum Norman Lamb. I have to say that Rabbi Lamb should have remained in the rabbinate. His ability to speak and bring out ideas, fabulous. This, I gave out a copy last week. It's Digging Out the Torah Insights. I got another copy. It's a review of Dr. Arnold Lustiger's Chumashim of the Rav. Fabulous. These go hand in hand. This is the Pew study about American families, and thank God in America, sacred ground of family still provides meaning for Americans. Read it with this article on what you don't know about the ultra-Orthodox. It's by a conservative rabbi professor at JTS. I happen to know him. Writing about the ultra-Orthodox, what we can learn from them. And the basic message is family. This is about a Jew who the Rebbe encouraged, an Israeli, winds up in America, remain in the meat business. And the Rebbe told him, no one should leave your store without food for Shabbos. And this man, if he knew someone couldn't afford the meat, the chicken, widows, yatomim, gave it to them for nothing, and he never lacked for success in his business. Beautiful story about the Rebbe. Here's another psychological story. A lady who didn't want to marry, she felt she had a temper and she wouldn't be kind to her husband, and the Rebbe talks her into marrying, and the end of the story is beautiful. Banim uvenei banim oskim b'torah mitzvot. And here's the Rebbe in his young years being Mesadik Kedushin. Here's another beautiful story of the Rebbe, how he befriended two young Afro-American boys. And one of them has written the book, Love Yourself, Love Each Other. And he cites his ability to write this. You see the picture of the blacks and the chassidim. He cites his encounter with the Rebbe on the streets of Crown Heights. This is for Morty, and I'll ask his opinion. Are they telling the truth? New Zealand, okay? Pass it back to Morty. It's for him. I saved it. And finally, for our hero, if anyone wants, I printed out the Wikipedia a description of Ben Hecht.
Oh.
Okay, if anyone wants it, it's yours for the asking. I want to thank my wonderful students sitting in front of me. I want to thank the many listening over the wide expanse of the universe. You can't believe I got calls all the way from Oregon yesterday. Well, Oregon, where am I? I hope I'm right. It's Oregon, the Washington, near Washington State.
Right,
yeah. So I'm right, Portland, Oregon. I got calls all the way from Oregon wishing me a happy birthday. And as happy as my birthday, it's much more happier. What a unique gift. And the Eibishter should give strength. We should see many, many, many more Jews in the world and many good rebbeim who will teach love of Yiddishkeit. Because when you know what Yiddishkeit is about, you have to become its greatest advocate. And to we are freilich in Chanukah, Chanukah Sameach, Chagurim Sameach, whichever way you say it, until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya.
Thank you. Thank you.